unusual aspects of this city that's come to your attention, let me explain. Justice Jacobs has a home that is situated where it makes it difficult for him to get to the open road. So he called this morning telling us that he would have difficulty making it. We've waited a half an hour in the hope that he still could. The only alternative was to bump your argument, move forward with four, or let you sit around all day in the hope that we could all catch even worse weather around 4 or 5 o'clock. So we've opted to go with four. Ready?
Morning. May it please the court. The medical negligence statute was enacted in 1976, and it defined two elements that a plaintiff is required to prove to establish a violation of the standard of care in a lack of informed consent case. The elements are contained in 6852A, which requires a plaintiff to show that the healthcare practitioner failed to disclose information customarily given to patients who were about to undergo a certain procedure. 68016 defines informed consent as a failure to provide information that a patient would consider to be material to the decision whether or not to undergo a procedure. In 1995, this court decided the Brzoska case. And in the Brzoska case, this court held, again, that there are two elements that a plaintiff must prove to establish a lack of informed consent case. And again, it was the failure to disclose information customarily given, and it was the failure to disclose information that a patient would consider to be material. 2 years later, this court decided the Barrio Canal case. And in that case, this court held specifically that the language contained in the statute is plain and unambiguous, and again held that there were two elements that a plaintiff is required to prove to establish a lack of informed consent. And again, those two elements were only the failure to disclose information customarily given and the failure to disclose information that the patient would consider to be material.
Can I stop you right there? Did either of those cases say, and having established the absence of informed consent, there is nothing more that needs to be established, such as proximate cause?
No, neither of them said that, but they were dealing with the issue of what constitutes the violation of the standard of care. And the violation of the standard of care, again, is defined only in 6801 and 6852. Proximate cause is defined or required by statute in 6853. And I don't think no one disputes that proximate cause is a necessary element to establish lack of informed consent because it's required in all medical malpractice cases under 6853. I think the problem in this case is the trial court attempted to combine the proximate cause requirement with the requirement for the violation of the standard of care. And there are two separate issues.
All right. I'm a little bit confused about that because I thought that the only issue was whether you had to prove proximate cause or not, and that it was agreed that this constituted a violation of the informed consent statute. Am I incorrect?
I think so.
Okay.
I think what the trial court did in this case is the trial court added an extra element of proof that a plaintiff must establish to show a violation of the standard of care. And the trial court combined proximate cause as an element to show a violation of the standard of care. There's always been, and in this case, there was still a requirement that the plaintiff show that the procedure itself constituted a violation of the standard of care.
Mr. Roseman, can help me understand the word material in the context of informed consent in a medical case and the extent to which material relates to the tort concept of proximate cause. Now, I ask that question because, to be honest with you, I'm more familiar with information that would be material to a stockholder in determining whether to sell or to buy shares. And it seems to me it directly relates to whether the materiality of the information would cause the shareholder to do one or the other. Is that an inaccurate or an improper way to look at the meaning of material in the informed consent context?
I think so.
Can you explain why?
Well, number one, to answer your initial question, material simply means important. That's how it's defined in the jury instruction. When the pattern jury instructions were drafted, the word material was changed to mean important.
Good. So it's not information that you believe the statute intended to define as determinative. No. The information was so important that it would actually have a direct effect on whether the individual would go forward with the operation or not.
Absolutely not. I think it has to be important information. In this case, the important information was that the procedure involved a risk of death. That was the important information that was withheld. Whether or not that fact would have changed the decision made by the patient to undergo the procedure is not an element that has to be proven under the statute. I think if the legislature intended that to be an element of the statute, then the statute would have contained that language. If you look at 6852B2, which is the defense to an informed consent case, that defense essentially says that if the defendant can prove that the patient assured the healthcare practitioner that they would undergo the procedure regardless of the risk, then there's no cause of action. And I think that really deals with the issue of materiality that Your Honor is referring to. And it was designed as a defense to a lack of informed consent case. The plaintiff wasn't required to show that definition of materiality to state a violation of the standard of care.
Well, what's wrong with this definition? A risk is material when a reasonable person, in what the physician knows or should know to be the patient's position, would be likely to attach significance to the risk or cluster of risks in deciding whether or not to undergo the proposed therapy. And I, just so you know where that comes from the Law Review article, Informed Consent to Therapy by Waltz and Schuneman, which was cited in the Canterbury case.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I followed the language completely.
I'll repeat it to help you, because I understood you said material means important. This is a little more comprehensive. It says, a risk is material when a reasonable person in what the physician knows or should know to be the patient's position would be likely to attach significance to the risk or cluster of risks in deciding whether or not to undergo the proposed therapy.
I'm not sure that's any different in our statute, because it seems to me what it's saying is it has to be something that a reasonable patient would consider to be important in deciding whether or not to undergo the procedure. And I think that's all that our statute says. I think what the trial court did is take it a step farther and say not only does it have to be important to the determination of whether or not to undergo the procedure, what the trial court said, it has to go beyond that, and it has to be sufficient that it would convince the patient not to undergo the procedure. So our statute, I believe, only requires the information to be important enough to affect the decision, not to make the determination of the decision, but it would be something that you would want to know in making your decision whether or not to have the surgery.
Well, but let me just read that, which our statute says, material to the decision whether or not to undergo the treatment, but before that it says, which a reasonable person would consider material. So it's really not that different than what Justice Ridgely read, is it?
I don't think so. I think it's really the same, because even what Justice Ridgely read, it still dealt with only the decision, whether or not it would be important to the decision, whether you would want to know about it. But what the trial court did, again, is go a step farther and say, not only does it have to be so important you would want to know about it, but it has to be so important it would change your mind.
Well, let's go back to Chief Justice Steele's reference to disclosure to shareholders. In a case we decided called Arnold versus Bancorp, we pointed out that we adopted the TCS standard of materiality, which is the federal standard. And it talks about if something's material, if a shareholder would want to know about it in deciding whether to hold or sell, and that you didn't have to demonstrate that they would have done either. You simply had to demonstrate that it would have been material, and to quote the case, in the total mix of information that a reasonable shareholder would want to know. Isn't that what you're really saying with regard to a patient?
Precisely. That.
Well, let's assume that you've gotten past that hurdle and that we can agree, at least for purposes of discussion right now, that a patient who's not told that there's a risk of death in a particular procedure, would be something that a reasonable person would consider material, the absence of that information. And that's been proven beyond a doubt. You know, there's no issue as to whether that disclosure was made or not. So don't we then get to the question of having not had the information, now the jury has to determine whether your patient, or rather whether a reasonable person, would have changed their mind if they knew?
I don't think so, because
in terms of proximate cause, why not?
Because the proximate cause issue then becomes a question of whether the patient who underwent the procedure without informed consent, and that's a wrongful act, that the patient underwent the procedure without giving his or her informed consent. So you now have a patient who, again, underwent a procedure without informed consent. The only remaining proximate cause issue should be whether that procedure caused injury. And that's what the pattern jury instruction says.
That point's basically conceded here. The procedure caused the death.
The court granted a directed verdict on that issue. The procedure caused death.
All right, and here's where I'm having some difficulty. If we know that a patient was not told of an important risk here, and we know that unfortunately that risk came to pass and the patient died, don't we still have to know or determine that if the patient had been given the information, the patient would have done something differently, as in not had the procedure?
Not under our statute, no. Our statute does not require that.
So your position is that this statute, in effect, has abrogated the common law.
No.
Normally, there's a duty. The duty's breached. There's a direct relationship between the breach of the duty, which we refer to as proximate cause, and the damages. And that's something missing here, the link between the informed consent and the damages, the traditional common law tort. But the statute's changed that?
No. I disagree that this case is different than traditional common law tort, and I disagree that the statute changed that. Again, the concept is the wrongful act is a patient undergoing a procedure that they didn't consent to. It's not whether they would have undergone the procedure. It's the fact that they underwent a procedure that they didn't consent to. Having undergone the procedure that they didn't consent to, the only issue of proximate cause is whether that procedure caused injury.
Yeah, and I understand your argument as you just articulated it. And my question is better proposed to your colleague, which I will when it's his turn. But I'm having trouble understanding the Superior Court's ruling. So I'll tell you what I think it means, and you tell me your reaction or how it's applied. If the way I understand it, if customarily you would tell people there's a risk of death, and if they knew there was a risk of death, they wouldn't have the procedure, whoever has the procedure? I just don't understand how it's a workable rule. If you say we customarily tell people there's a risk of death, and then the plaintiff has to show everyone who is customarily told there's a risk of death never has the procedure.
That's exactly right. It would be an impossible case for a plaintiff to prove. I mean, this case was tried twice, and it was, I think the evidence was clear that there was a 1 in 1,000 risk of death if this procedure is performed. The plaintiff wasn't told of that, and the plaintiff died as a result of the procedure.
So your point is the risk of death is customarily told. It's material, and it's important in the mix of things a patient would want to know to make an informed decision. If you weren't told something that's material to making an informed decision, your consent wasn't informed. And then if you underwent a procedure and were injured, you've established your case.
Exactly. That's my argument.
Help me understand the context of the rule that you would like us to adopt among some other risks where there may be a lesser risk than death. I want to quote to you again from the same Law Review article. It says, the causation issue, then, is resolved on the basis of all material risks, disclosed or undisclosed. If disclosure of all material risks would have made no difference to the decision of a reasonable person in the position of the patient, there is no causal connection between nondisclosure and the plaintiff's injury. For instance, it would be reasonable to conclude that a patient who required brain surgery to survive would not have refused it, even if had he known of an undisclosed risk of speech impediment. Conversely, if disclosure of all material risks would cause a reasonable person in the patient's position to refuse the therapy, a causal connection is established. What's wrong with that analysis?
Again, the injury is not only the fact that the patient died. The injury is the fact that the patient underwent a procedure to which she did not give informed consent. I mean, informed consent and battery, and I'm not arguing that our statute is a battery statute, but there's sort of a symbiotic relationship between informed consent and battery. And the wrongful act is performing a procedure on a patient who didn't give informed consent to have that procedure performed.
But do you agree that this statute is under the context of medical negligence and not a battery?
Clearly. I'm not remotely making that argument, but what I am saying is that there is some relationship between lack of informed consent and battery. That was discussed in the Brzozowska case. And, I mean, clearly there's a relationship there, but I'm not arguing that our statute isn't a negligent statute. It is a negligent statute. But what all these cases miss is what the wrongful act is. And that wrongful act, again, is performing a surgical procedure on a patient who didn't give consent to that procedure or give informed consent to that procedure.
So in this hypothetical about a patient who required brain surgery to survive would not have refused that even if he had known of an undisclosed risk of a speech impediment, your contention is that there are damages due for in the event there is a speech impediment result.
Not necessarily, because the issue becomes, and it's an issue for a jury to decide, is whether the failure to inform the patient of a of the risk of a speech impediment developing was material information. And if it wasn't material information, then it doesn't have to, you don't have to inform the patient of that risk. I mean, if the court is going to look at that, then my response would be, if you're going to refine the statute, then you refine the statute to say, if a risk isn't disclosed and the plaintiff wants to bring a cause of action, then the injury has to be the risk that wasn't disclosed. So in your case, if the patient wasn't informed of a speech, the possibility that there may be a resulting speech impediment, then the only cause of action would be if there was a resulting lack of speech impediment. In this case, the information that wasn't provided was the risk of death, and that's what occurred. Now, I don't think that that our statute requires that, because, again, to me, what the trial court did wrong is it took a statute. This court has held that the statute's language is plain and unambiguous. And then the trial court engrafted this extra element of proof that's not contained in the statute. That's what the trial court did wrong. And I'm trying to remember Canterbury, but I think Canterbury was based upon a statute that that had that requirement that the plaintiff show that they would have decided differently. I think virtually all the cases that the trial court relied upon were based upon statutory language that contained that additional element. And our statute doesn't require it.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I respectfully disagree that the wrongful act is the procedure itself. In this case, there was a discussion of risks and benefits, but there was not a discussion that death was one of those risks, and there was a dispute about that under standard of care. So the wrongful act, the negligence, if you will, under the informed consent, was the failure to inform the patient that there was a risk of death. There's nothing in the informed consent statute under 6852 or the definition of that changes the common law regarding proximate cause. In fact, I would argue that the statute refers twice to it's part of the medical negligence scheme. It falls under the medical negligence statutes.
Well, could you apply the Superior Court holding in this case to Justice Ridgely's hypothetical and tell us what you think the plaintiff would have to prove. And so the situation is you need brain surgery, and one of the risks is speech impediment. You're not told about that, and you have the operation. Is the Superior Court holding such that the plaintiff would have to come in and said, everybody has this operation. Nobody declines to have this operation because of the risk of speech impediment.
Let me apply that. Under a traditional but-for test of causation, first you would go to the language of the informed consent statute.
No, let's stick with my hypothetical, okay? Well, if you're applying the Superior Court case, that's fine. But as I understand the Superior Court ruling, it is that, first, under the statute, this is something that people are customarily told. There may be a speech impediment.
you were not told that there may be a speech impediment. And now the question is, what's the plaintiff's burden of proof? The way I read the Superior Court holding, the plaintiff needs to come in and say, no one would have had brain surgery if they had been told there was a risk of speech impediment. Is that the holding?
I think the holding would be that a reasonable person in the position of the person having the brain surgery would have had to have chosen a different result. But see, and that is a fair application of the Superior Court ruling, because under the traditional...
That not a reasonable person, no reasonable person.
No, they would have to prove that a reasonable person in the position or circumstances of the plaintiff would have chosen a different result.
So how do you do that? Because no one would ever have brain surgery. Where does the plaintiff marshal their proof? Because if everyone who needs brain surgery is told that there's a risk of speech impediment, and everyone that hears about the risk of speech impediment declines, that can't be the rule, can it?
Well, I think it can, because if you're looking at the proximate cause element and whether the physician told the patient or didn't tell the patient that they would have a speech impediment for brain surgery, let's say hypothetically that they told this exact patient that you would have a speech impediment because of brain surgery.
No, risk.
Risk of speech impediment. And the patient would have elected to go forward with the surgery anyway, and then had a speech impediment, there would be no causation. It wouldn't have made any difference. The question is, in applying proximate cause, what negligence or the breach or the failure by the doctor, what difference did that make in the result? And if you look at the traditional proximate cause language, you know, but for that negligence, would it have made a difference if the same result would have happened? But even if the person was negligent.
Don't you think realistically, in this hypothetical where we're talking about brain surgery and speech impediment, if that's something customarily told to people, and if it's material, the answer would be most people have the surgery, some people decide not to have the surgery. But it's something everybody should know about so they can make an informed decision whether to have the surgery. And that seems to be practical. Where I'm having trouble, and I'd like your help, and that's why I asked about applying the Superior Court ruling, is if you have to say no reasonable person would have had the surgery, that's quite a burden.
I don't think that's quite the holding. I mean, in my mind at least, the holding tries to encompass the various scenarios that a patient might have when facing brain surgery. It may be a patient that only has 2 months to live or other comorbid conditions. So a reasonable patient in that position, having been informed of that risk, may have chosen not to go forward with the brain surgery. So the application is to try and go to any scenario that might exist to consider that patient's unique circumstances, but put it in a reasonable person standard. So there could be, the plaintiffs would not have to come in and prove that all patients would not have the surgery. Just a reasonable patient, under these circumstances, for that patient, would have chosen not to undergo the surgery.
So tell me how we get from the statute, which says a reasonable person would want to know it, it's material, to the Superior Court holding that you need to show, knowing it, no one would have the operation.
There are two parts. The language regarding whether a reasonable person would consider that material goes to the whether that information would be provided or would, you know, in part customarily be provided. Is that something a patient would want to know or not? The second part of that equation, just as the standard of care and then proximate cause, would be would that information have provided to that patient, would that have changed the outcome? Would it have changed the decision? So the first part of the application in applying the statute would be, is that the information customarily given? Would a reasonable patient consider that material? Let's say you get yes and yes to both of those questions for the speech impediment risk. Now you go to the second question on proximate cause. Would a reasonable patient in that position have decided differently? Would they have undergone the procedure or not have undergone the procedure? And that would be a unique jury question depending upon the medical condition of that patient. Now, I would agree, candidly, the majority of patients would probably go forward with that procedure, and that may be evidence. But this plaintiff may have some unique circumstances or belief where a reasonable person in that position would not have gone forward. So the jury still gets to decide the proximate cause element. And there's nothing in the statute. I mean, if you think of informed consent, it really goes to the decision. So now the decision is going to be important in providing information, but we're going to ignore the decision, or we're not going to consider whether the patient would have gone through that procedure or not in determining proximate cause.
Well, let me approach it from a slightly different perspective. Why isn't the use of the term material, what a reasonable person would deem material in the statute, be the factor that provides the proximate cause? In other words, if a jury determines that the absence of this information is something that would be material to a reasonable person, and material means important or significant or, affecting their decision-making, whatever definition you want to use, that becomes the issue that must be decided by the jury. And if the jury says, yes, a reasonable person would consider this absent information important, material, that you've now met your burden of showing proximate cause without having to then say, but do we know whether a reasonable person would then make a decision one way or the other? Because people have a lot of different reasons for making their decisions as to what kind of procedures they'll undergo. And arguably, the statute is designed to protect people who aren't able to make that decision because an important piece of information wasn't given them, regardless of whether you can prove that that person would have done something differently.
I think the issue of materiality is important in the context of information being provided to a patient that they would want to know. And I'm not, that issue of materiality, might be bleeding or death or some other type of risk. So is that information important? And part of that equation is determining whether the doctor should provide that information to a patient or should not. It's an interplay between the patient and the physician as to what type of, is it customarily given? Would the patient consider this important? I don't think that gets you, under the statute and under the case law on proximate cause to definitively proving proximate cause. See, because the interpretation of the statute where you say it's a proximate cause from the surgery itself ignores the entire part of the decision that would play in informed consent in making that. And if the negligent act is failing to provide the information, then the question is, what difference would that have made in the decision? And under your scenario, it assumes that the withholding of all material information would almost be like a strict liability situation where that proximate cause is automatically established.
And looking at this statute, help me understand the relationship between the concept of the information being material and 6852A2, which says you can't recover on the basis of informed consent unless the information that would customarily be supplied to patients was not supplied. What's the relationship between that and materiality?
I think there is an interplay between them, and it considers two concepts. The idea of customarily being given would more relate to the physicians and the standard of care and what physicians in the community or what they learned in their training are routinely doing on informed consent. Whether a reasonable patient would consider it material seems to go a little bit more to the patient side of that equation, but I would argue there's some interplay between both of them, because what a patient would consider material would probably help drive what becomes is customarily.
Well, is it any more complicated than that information might be material, as Justice Berger described it, of significance? We'll use that as the shortest definition of material, to a patient about to consider surgery, but that in addition to that, the information that might have been material must also be that which is customarily given. This patient can't have some unique concept of what would be material to them, so it puts it back in the realm of a reasonable person, not particular to this individual, correct? And,
yeah.
And after that point, is, at least as I understand the scheme of the statute, there's nothing else the plaintiff has to prove. The plaintiff doesn't have to prove that all other people confronted with the same situation would decline the surgery. It shifts to the defense to say that the injured party would have undergone the treatment regardless of the risk involved. That's not something the plaintiff has to establish.
I respectfully disagree. I think that the element of proximate cause, the preponderance of evidence, is the plaintiff's burden, not the defense burden.
Well, let's assume first the information is that which a reasonable person would deem to be material in making a decision where to undergo surgery. Secondly, it's information that's customarily given, because you can't recover unless you can establish that. It's not unique information. It's not somebody that has a particular religion that makes it important that you not use electricity when you operate on them or something like that. Then under defenses is the first time the statute starts talking about who has the burden of establishing that the patient would or would not undergo the treatment notwithstanding. That's not shifted to the plaintiff. It says, in any action for medical negligence, in addition to other defenses provided by law, the injured party assured the health care provider he or she would undergo the treatment regardless of the risk involved.
That's an interesting point, and I guess I hadn't thought about it that way, but let's explore that for just a second. Let's assume that there is a lack of proximate cause, that most patients would undergo this procedure anyway. My analysis of the defense is that the plaintiff meets the element on standard of care of reasonable material and customarily given. Then, because it's under the medical negligence statute, the plaintiff has the burden of proving that the failure to give a risk of death would have made a difference in a reasonable patient under these circumstances. Under the scenario
well,
that
different.
You're...
that's different than the Superior Court opinion, because under that articulation, if the plaintiff could come in and say some people have the surgery, some people decline, the plaintiff's case would still be viable. But the Superior Court said the plaintiff had to show no reasonable patient would have gone forward.
No, my interpretation of the opinion is would a reasonable patient in the position of this plaintiff have gone forward? It's not no reasonable patient. It's considering the circumstances of this particular patient and then a reasonable person standard applied to that. It's not an absolute that no patient would go forward.
No, I understand, and I accept your distinction. But still, the plaintiff would only have to come forward under that explanation and say some people would decline. Is that right?
Right, or this particular plaintiff in this position, a reasonable person in this plaintiff's position would have declined. But I guess the point that I'm making, and I want to get back to Justice Steele's point in a minute, the point that I'm making is that under traditional proximate cause, if the same result would have happened with the negligence, then it didn't make a difference in the ultimate outcome. It's not that it's not important. It's not that it shouldn't be given. The question in proximate cause is, what difference did it make in the outcome? And under the analysis where you ignore or don't consider whether a reasonable patient in that position would have gone forward with that procedure, then you're taking that out of the equation, which is the part of the essential part of informed consent.
But doesn't the statute take that out of the equation? The statute could just as easily have said informed consent is what is customarily provided and what a reasonable person would find material, and what would have changed the person's decision. It doesn't go that far. It doesn't say that you have to establish that the person's decision would have changed, only that the person was not given important information. At that point, it doesn't matter what the patient's decision would or wouldn't have been. The point is the patient didn't get a chance to make an informed decision. So we can't come in after the fact and say, well, would a reasonable person have decided one way or the other way? If it's a material piece of information, that in itself means that a reasonable person might have used that information to make a different result.
But the statute, at least my reading of it, is that the first section says an order, no cause of action for damages for informed consent can be recovered unless you go to number one and then you go to number two. And one is it's a non-emergency, and two is that it's information customarily given.
That's the material.
And none of that addresses the concept of proximate cause.
Well, that's why I asked you the question about B2, because it says a defense is the injured party assured the health care provider that he or she would undergo the treatment regardless of the risk. That suggests to me, at any rate, that the General Assembly had in mind that a person informed properly, who went ahead and then told the physician, I will voluntarily undergo the risk, that's a defense. Now, what if that doesn't happen impliedly, if the informed consent isn't given? If you flip that coin, you could argue that it's no defense if the injured party never had the opportunity to tell the health care provider that he or she would undergo the treatment regardless of the risk.
B deals with, in medical negligence, there, in addition to other defenses, there are these additional defenses. But before I get there, and I still think that the plaintiff has the burden under the traditional medical negligence theory and proximate cause, which has been around for a long time.
Sure, and I understand why you say that, because B says it, as a prefacing comment, in any action for medical negligence, and it says in addition to other defenses. But what we're trying to get at is the extent to which a statute has abrogated, if at all, traditional common law principles. We know that the General Assembly can do that. We know that the General Assembly has paid careful attention over many years to trying to get the correct balance between plaintiff's opportunity to have a remedy for medical malpractice and balance it against the availability of physicians and the cost of medical malpractice insurance and all the rest of that. We don't live in a cave. We understand all that. So what we're trying to understand here is, within this concept of informed consent, now that a statute has overlaid or abrogated the common law, what did the General Assembly how did the General Assembly intend it to work?
My interpretation, and I think a very fair reading of that, is they did not intend to do away with traditional proximate cause opinions, because twice in the statute they say under medical negligence. In medical negligence, in all cases where lawyers are defending them and plaintiffs are bringing them, proximate cause is a critical component, and even in the cases dealing with it, it's a separate component. So nothing about that statute tended to abrogate common law principles of proximate cause.
Okay. Now, having listened carefully to Mr. Roseman's comments, help me understand this. He says giving informed consent is a duty that was breached here because the patient wasn't told there was a 1 in 1,000 chance of death if she underwent the procedure. The breach of that duty was a failure to provide the customary information and to give the patient an opportunity to say they would undergo the treatment nevertheless. That constitutes the wrong. The fact that it was followed by an operation that actually caused death is not even material to this case. The wrong has already occurred. The duty has been breached. The damages are simply she underwent, uninformed, a procedure that ultimately resulted in her death. He would say, I think, although I'm at risk, he's so articulate for me to even try to re-express his view, but he would say that traditional tort elements had already been met before the operation took place.
I respectfully disagree, and there's nothing in the statute that gives that interpretation.
Help me understand the limits of this reasonable person test. Let's assume, hypothetically, as in this case, that the risk of anesthesia is told, and the patient signs a form that there's a 0.0002% risk of death. And the patient says to the doctor, gee, doc, that's good news, because, you know, if anything had been at 0.1% risk of death or greater, I wouldn't do this surgery. Now, under the facts of this case, there is a 0.1% risk of death. The doctor doesn't inform of that risk. So now we have an exact correlation, clear evidence, let's assume it's in the chart, of a intention to refuse this surgery if a risk, particular risk, had been disclosed. And the plaintiff, and assume, let's, I'd like to get your answer to that, and then assume that a reasonable person would still go forward with the surgery, but this particular plaintiff with the sort of the glass jaw approach would not.
If it was a pure subjective standard, then that patient's testimony would be the, I would have gone, not have gone forward, and then they would have established that element. If you apply the reasonable person standard to the patient in that circumstances or this plaintiff, then the jury would have to decide, giving this plaintiff's beliefs, this plaintiff's set of circumstances, is that a reasonable position, and then decide that proximate cause.
So the reasonable person would trump the express desire of the plaintiff, I don't want this surgery if there's a risk of death of 0.1%.
I think it's a balancing point between a reasonable person and this plaintiff's position. And the reason that reasonable person standard sort of came about is because in the two scenarios in the case, one would be the patient has the procedure, the injuries occurred, and now it's after the fact. So there's this hindsight bias where that patient would say, well, of course I wouldn't have undergone it. Or the second scenario where the patient is deceased and then there's no testimony by that person what they would or wouldn't do. So I think the jury would apply the reasonable person standard under the circumstances of this plaintiff, and if they find that is a reasonable position, then they would have established their proximate cause. There's nothing in the statute.
Your time's up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chief Justice, under or answering your question, I would agree that once the patient undergoes a procedure that in which they were not provided material information, the tort has occurred. There has been a violation of the standard of care. That establishes the violation of the standard of care. But the next issue, which is in the statute, is did that tort cause damages? Did that tort cause an injury? And the answer to be, my answer would be, you still have to prove that the tortious conduct caused an injury. In this case, the injury caused by the procedure was death. So again, I'm not arguing that a plaintiff doesn't have to show damages or doesn't have to show causation. I think the plaintiff has to show damages and causation because it's required under 6853. But the damages and causation are based upon the procedure, not the question of whether or not to undergo the procedure, because once you undergo the procedure without informed consent, the tort has been committed.
Okay.
The next issue is, did that tort cause damages? And I'll point out, I think that's the distinction. I know Justice Berger wrote a decision in the Valentin case. And the difference between the Valentin case and this case is the fact that in the Valentin case, there was no evidence that the lack of informed consent caused an injury. In fact, in that case, the plaintiff's expert testified that the outcome would have been the same whether or not the procedure was in that case, the patient wasn't told that there was a tumor and that there could have been a surgery performed as a result of the tumor. The plaintiff's expert testified simply that there was no damage caused because the patient would have died whether or not they underwent the procedure or not. So I don't think, Justice Berger, that you would be changing your decision in the Valentin case if you found in favor of the plaintiff in this case. Because, again, the difference is, in this case, the procedure definitely caused injury, caused death. And in Valentin, the testimony was there was no injury and no damages. And that's the difference. And I'm not suggesting that a plaintiff under our wrongful death statute doesn't have to show injury and damages. They do. And I think it was proven in this case. I mean, again, I think what the Superior Court did is that it took a defense, an affirmative defense, and made that part of the plaintiff's burden. And that's not what the statute permits.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.